We're expanding On Being's Civil Conversations project to be more of a resource for families and communities, for the work of starting new conversations where we live and building common life for this century. Because the point of speaking together differently is to live together differently. Go to civilconversationsproject.org and find audio, video, even a starter guide. Again, that's civilconversationsproject.org.
On Being is brought to you by the John Templeton Foundation. The Templeton Foundation supports academic research and civil dialogue on the deepest, most perplexing questions facing humankind. Who are we? Why are we here? And where are we going? To learn more, please visit templeton.org. The Templeton Foundation. Stay curious.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being's Unheard Cut. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Lindsay Stonebridge. Listen to our produced show with her wherever you find your podcasts, and as always, at onbeing.org.
Hi.
Hi, Krista.
Yes, Lindsay. So we managed to connect to France, but our printer wasn't working. Technology is, you know, never the whole answer. I'm sure Hannah Arendt would find something interesting about this.
That's
I'm
great.
So glad to be talking to you. I just was very animated by that, you know, the podcast In Our Time, and especially by you. I actually, because your voices sounded a little similar, just the timbre of them. And so
yeah.
I had to go back and say, okay, now who's that? That's Lindsay.
No, a couple of people said that. It's
yeah.
kind of British women's voices.
Well, you kind of, I mean, you were very different in terms of your style of speaking. But yeah, it was a little, because I couldn't tell when, you know, he didn't, unless you were really listening carefully, it's like I couldn't tell who he was, you know,
yeah,
who it was, name whose name was being given. So I have way
I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah. Well, I have way too many notes, but I think we should just plunge in and have a pretty wide-ranging conversation about this.
Great.
Okay. I guess we need a little bit more of you. Why don't you just tell me something mundane, like what you had for lunch?
I had some salad for lunch and some leftover risotto, but it was under the sun of the southwestern France, southwestern France to early spring, so it was beautiful.
Oh.
Is that okay, Chris?
Yeah. Are you on sabbatical?
No. We have a slightly longer Easter vacation
okay. mm-hmm.
in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And I spend as much time as I can down here because I have family here
okay.
and we have a house here
mm-hmm.
and it's where I get to write and think.
Okay.
I'm also about an hour away from where Hannah Arendt was in a detention camp in Gurs.
Oh, really?
So every time I'm around here, I always have a moment where I think about that.
Hmm.
And think about the people who came through Montauban, which is about an hour from here, which is a big refugee town, and Toulouse. Mm. So this area's got lots of Arendt in it,
right?
In some ways, for me,
I wonder. I wanted to ask you, and I'm wondering if this starts to get at that. How you, you know, what in the background of your life inclined you to be captured by her passions and ideas? Are there points of resonance that go back for you as well?
Yeah, I think it took me a long time to come to Arendt. Because when I first read her as an undergraduate, and we all read The Origins of Totalitarianism, and it seemed like history. And it wasn't until the end of the Cold War when I started working on a book called The Judicial Imagination.
Yeah.
And in that book, I wanted to understand how people judged the Holocaust, how people judged what had happened in World War II. And I was quite suspicious because when I started work, it was the end of the Cold War. People were talking about justice and human rights again. And I was skeptical of that account. And Arendt's clarity on the issue of moral responsibility knocked me out straight away. And I think it was actually much later in my life that I came to her. And it was a sense of moral and historical clarity that she had. I was thinking about this morning. The other figure who's very important to me, who's also a very strong Jewish woman, was Melanie Klein, the psychoanalyst. Mm. And Klein had a question, which was, where does evil come from? She was a psychoanalyst. She wanted to understand this question. Where does aggression come from? Why are we so mean? And I spent a lot of time thinking about that with Klein and only got so far. And Hannah Arendt asked another question, which I think is uniquely important, which is, how in modern times is evil organized? Mm-hmm. Because we can't stop where evil comes from, but we can talk about how it's organized. We can try and understand that. So there's that. There's also, she was very committed to the idea that, you know, people who felt like they were outsiders and spectators in their worlds could have a contribution to make to that world, could understand that world from a certain perspective, and could engage with it. And I think my family were we were the first generation middle class. My parents were the first to go to college. Mm. The class system in Britain and Europe, as you know, is very tight.
Right.
Always having that sense of being a slight outsider and not quite knowing. Not quite being able to talk the language. And Arendt's so brilliant on talking about, you know, being inside and outside, being a parvenu, and wanting to blend, wanting to be, you know, part of a culture, and actually, you know, or being a pariah, being that you know you're coming from the outside, you know you're not quite right, and seizing that and running with it and working with it. And she also had that angle for me.
Well, and of course, she was a German-Jewish intellectual who had to flee Germany in 1933 and was a stateless refugee for years. And what was, when she was in, where is it in France where you are, Gore?
She was in Paris, like but she was deported to, Gurs detention camp.
And wasn't she something an alien, some kind of...
Yeah, she was an enemy alien. Enemy alien.
Mm-hmm.
So when Germans were rounded up by the French at the beginning of the war, everyone was pushed together. So she was actually deported with other Jewish women, but also with Nazis and anyone who happened to be German. And they were brought down to Gurs camp, which was an all-women's camp. And it's very interesting because Gurs used to be a camp for fleeing Spanish Republicans. Mm. It's in the Pyrenees and it's near the border. Mm. And she came there and, she said it was the only time in her life. And the other thing I really like about Arendt is her relentless, in the face of horrible reality, commitment to life. So it's the only time in her life she committed suicide. She fought for committing suicide. And if you pushed her a bit on that, when she was in the detention camp. And that wasn't actually personal. That was in the context of a discussion between the women, whether they'd do it collectively to thwart the will of the Nazis. So it wasn't personal despair. It would have been an utterly political act.
Aren't we glad?
But she didn't.
Do that.
Yeah, we're very glad she didn't.
Yeah.
I mean, she did the thing that she always, you know, they set up a reading group and she taught political philosophy in the camp to other women.
Wow.
And it's where she first began thinking about origins of Torah. Well, she'd begun a bit earlier, but she also, you know, crystallized the themes of thinking about origins of totalitarianism as she was living it. There's a lovely story that Lisa Fitko tells. Lisa Fitko was one of the people who used to smuggle people over the Pyrenees. And she'd escaped too. And she found Hannah Arendt just outside Montauban, which is where a lot of the refugees went to, because Montauban was a kind of ville of refuge. It was a city of refuge. Mm. Wandering around a field, just thinking to herself. She sort of said, well, what are you doing? There's a war on. There's all this happening. And I'm just thinking. I'm just taking the opportunity to have some solitude and to think this through.
There's so many roads I want to walk down, and I hope we get to walk down quite a few. The idea of what drew you to her, you know, moral clarity. And I think... you know, just for me, rereading The Origins of Totalitarianism, dipping back into her after quite a few years, that she wasn't just that this is not a historical, it's not history telling. It's really a delving into the human essence of what we experience and analyze as political historical events. And it, I think that, you know, even the term moral clarity, or, you know, a term I'm using a lot these days, moral imagination.
Yes.
I think among the many things that have surfaced, and I this has surfaced as much in Europe as it has in the U.S., is that we are lacking space for moral imagination and even, you know, a conversation and thinking about moral clarity. So as we talk about her, you know, as you know very well, you know, this is a moment where I think you wrote somewhere Hannah Arendt is trending. And, you know, The Origins of Totalitarianism from 1951 is on bestseller lists. And The Guardian in 2017 will write an article with the title like Totalitarianism in the Age of Trump, Lessons from Hannah Arendt.
Yes.
And
yes.
I don't think it's there's certainly parallels you can draw. And we will talk about how she understood totalitarianism. But it's a very imperfect translation to the 21st century. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be more interesting for us to explore, as you point out in some of your writing, you know, where is it? There's this great, I'm just going to read this this piece you've just written, or has this been published?
It's a piece that's just about to come out in Jewish Quarterly.
Right. Do you know when it will come out?
It's any day now.
Okay, great. So good. Okay. So I'm just going to read. This is a rather longish passage, but it's great, and I think it's a good way to frame what we're going to do. You said, if there is a bar in the underworld where the lost angels of history now hang out, I imagine Arendt drawing on her eternal cigarette and issuing us a word of caution about the contemporary relevance of her work. Yes, today we see something of the same insouciant banality that crept into the political culture in the last century. Yes, there are the outrageous lies that infuriate, not because they're lies, and I think this is such an interesting point you're making, and you know, children and some of our best friends lie all the time, but because it is lonely and terrifying to live in a world where political lies are accepted, even if cynically. It is true, too, that many of the political elements that helped till the soil of totalitarianism in the 20th century are again unblushingly conspicuous. But another sigh of smoke, a slight closing of the eyelids. The mistake we made last time was to try and derive the unprecedented from things that had already happened. We didn't think properly. Your reality is both similar but different in ways you will have to work out. To do that, she might conclude, you'd be best advised to make some new friends so that together you can learn to, quote-unquote, think without banisters. So I hope you and I can kind of imagine her accompanying us in that deliberation in terms of moral clarity in the moment we inhabit. Does that sound okay with you?
Yes, that sounds very good.
You know, I'm just going to say right here, I think one of the most striking things, so having just said that I don't think we should stretch to draw analogies, she wrote The Origins of Totalitarianism I think she finished writing in 1949, which is 4 years after Hitler has died, and I believe 4 years before Stalin would die. Mm-hmm. Really, in the thick of dynamics that were very much about the 20th century. But something that struck me so much that I had forgotten is this idea about the isolation of, like, that she wrote, what prepares men for totalitarian domination? And here again is what happens in the human heart and psyche and society that makes these things possible is the fact that loneliness, once a borderline experience, usually suffered in certain marginal social conditions like old age, has become an everyday experience of the ever-growing masses of our century. And if I think about the Brexit experience in the UK, and I think about this last presidential election in the US, so much of the dynamic were human beings who had felt unseen and feel disconnected. Mm-hmm. That language she says, atomized, isolated individuals.
Yeah. Yeah. And she makes a further distinction in the last chapter of Origins of Totalitarianism, which she wrote later, mm-hmm. between uprootedness, which is what people, which, you know, since the Industrial Revolution, this has happened, but obviously it's got worse, and in periods of economic crisis, it gets far worse, is not feeling recognised, not feeling at home. So there's a kind of malaise of uprootedness. Yeah. And she contrasts and compares with superfluousness, yeah. which is not being in the world at all, not being treated like you're in the world at all. And that was the camps, and that is the refugee camp. So there's this awful relationship between the uprooted of the world in Europe, in mm-hmm. the States, mm-hmm. and the new superfluous of the world, which she understood very well, because mm-hmm. she was one of the superfluous of the world in the 1940s.
Right.
So I think she was very interested in that relationship. And I think you're absolutely right. The loneliness is absolutely crucial, but it's, you know, the question of how we imagine a response to that.
Yeah.
I think it's very interesting. I've discovered recently that Hannah Arendt taught George Orwell's 1984 to Berkeley undergraduates in 1955. And
another new bestseller.
Which, you know, what would one give to have been in that classroom? Many of your listeners were in Berkeley in 1955,
right.
being taught 1984 by Hannah Arendt. I would love to hear.
Yeah. And
she had read, I think she'd read the novel earlier, because she started rewriting the last chapter of Origins of Totalitarianism on that question of loneliness and the new totalitarianism, which was going to be part of a later book on Marxism and Bolshevism. She never quite, it took different routes. So she's getting that kind of analysis of Orwell. She's in dialogue with Orwell, who's, of course, dead by then. And he's saying, actually, this is what happens. The original title of 1984 was The Last Man in Europe. And if you can hear the Brexit resonances there, The Last Man in Europe.
Yeah.
And the loneliness. And the reason why Winston Smith is so drawn to Big Brother in the end is he cannot bear being alone. he cannot bear being alone with his own worst nightmares, which is the rat torture scenario. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, you know, Arendt understood that very, very well. And as indeed did Orwell. And I think you're absolutely right, listening to that kind of cri de coeur, that cry of the heart around not having a place to go.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, she would, you know, she would have been, I think, very, very cautious of having too ready answers to what you do with that dilemma.
Right,
I mean, she'd
been
very, very suspicious of throwing up another worldview or ideology to end the loneliness. I think she'd be very impatient with the way that those of us who are trying to react to our current scenarios, both in the UK and the US, are either turning on each other or blaming the liberal elite or blaming high capitalism or blaming whatever. She would actually be, I think she'd be saying, oh no, you need to sort of slow down here and think about what you're actually seeing. Making people unlonely is a good project, but how that's going to happen, what politics you need for that to happen, is going to be a very, very hard question.
Right. Or even
the other thing, just to go back.
I was going to say, or even if politics is the place where that would start, if it would be a political project, which is a different kind of question to raise in the 21st century than it was in the 20th century.
Absolutely.
And I mean, that is something I wanted to ask you also, because she had this insistence that people should be more political, which meant one thing mm-hmm. for her. And maybe this is a way in which the foundation on which that idea was based in her century is so different. I mean, because politics itself is called into question in a different way as part of our crisis.
Yeah.
How do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, she did, the model that was always in the back of her head was the agora, the Greek polis, where the marketplace of ideas, where politics was always being renewed as people were appearing to each other. And she knew that wasn't a simple, straightforward nostalgia. She'd say, I'm not nostalgic for the Greek Republic. I'm nostalgic for the possibilities that then could open up out of that scenario. And I said, as I said before, if you try to recreate the Greek polis today, or even in the 60s and 70s when Arendt was writing about the American Republic, it would look like Star Trek. You'd have, you know, people discussing earnest, you know, philosophical questions about what to do and what the morally correct thing to do, while machines were making life for you and keeping everything going, and you're whizzing through space and time, and you know, right. It's impossible. It's a fantasy, right? But she did also have a commitment. I mean, it's why she really did like the idea of the United States, even though she would sometimes profess to be disappointed with the reality. Is a kind of, you know, a federal politics of based around the local that would check the politics of nationalism, would check state politics. And I think she would have, you know, what I think she, if she was, I was rereading her stuff on civil disobedience and students and the mm-hmm. student uprisings mm-hmm. from 1968. I'm wondering what she'd be saying now. And on the one hand, I think she'd be absolutely really excited because what she liked about the students in 68, particularly the civil rights movement, etc., was the fact that it was a moral protest. This was people saying, this is not enough, this is not good enough, this is morally wrong. And she would have liked that a lot. And I think that is happening both in the UK and certainly in the US, and she would have liked that very much. And I think she might have been even slightly more excited now than she was in the early 70s or late 60s, mm-hmm. because back then what she didn't like is the way people resorted to old ideologies to try and fix up answers. So the return of a new kind of socialism or a new kind of Marxism or a new kind of this or that. And I think she'd have taken that crisis in the political that you've talked about, where everything is sort of like at ground zero, as an opportunity for the new, as right, an opportunity right. for new thinking. The things she'd have disapproved of as well. I mean, she did tend to sound like someone's very cross aunt. And she was disapproving of some student politics, and I think there'll be some of that too. And she was hopeless.
I don't think she would like aspects. The simplification, the categories, right? Which get resorted to of entire swaths of human beings, which happens on both sides Certainly. Of the political spectrum, yeah. Even in the, you know, on campuses, certainly,
yeah. Yeah. I was very interested about your question about imagination, because I think we talk a lot today about empathy and suffering. Mm-hmm. And I'm like Arendt, I'm always a bit wary. It sounds like a terrible thing to say. I'm really a bit wary about empathy.
About that, because when we talk, you know, when we start talking about loneliness, which as we're discussing it in the context of her work, I mean, it's clearly the human condition and it can be a personal experience, yeah. but it's not talking about loneliness as something that, you know, if we can be compassionate towards each other's loneliness, things will get better.
Yeah.
So how do you think she would, just how do you do it? Because obviously I think you channel her a little bit. That's why I'm talking to you.
Well, I think... she was critical of pity, and she wrote very famously in her own revolution book mm-hmm. that what she didn't like about pity is it kept the power relationship. You know, other people suffering, for the one who's doing the pitying or the empathizing, keeps the power. Mm-hmm. Okay, mm-hmm. And also she didn't like it because once you have suffering as your ground zero, you can allow for anything in the name to end that suffering. And that was the tragedy for her of the French Revolution. You know, we have to be piteous in order to, you know, save the suffering people. And I feel that way a little bit about empathy. But I want to go back to something that you raised, Krista, earlier, which is the question, when she's talking about imagination, she is really thinking through Kant here. And she's thinking about what it's like not necessarily to imagine not being in the place you're in, to be imagined to be in the place of another. And that's slightly different from pity. And it's a slightly different take from empathy because it involves something a bit harder, actually. When I was reading her teaching notes for her classes, she used to teach a course where she taught at Cornell, Chicago, and I think at the New School called Political Experience in the 20th Century. And I was delighted to see her teaching notes as a teacher myself. And she said what she wanted to do by getting the students to read things like Orwell and Kafka, and as well as the great kind of philosophical and political writers of the time, was to imagine an experience not like your, unlike your own. So when she's teaching to Berkeley students in 1955, she says, imagine what it was like to have the political experience of a European, which is an experience totally unlike yours. And then she puts in brackets, a bit like mine, but totally unlike yours, and which I thought was very sweet, given that, you know, given what she'd just been through.
Yeah.
And I think it's that kind of, and what Kant teaches us to do is not just to empathise, but which is actually to build blueprints or worlds or frames for understanding experience that is not ours, that cannot be incorporated into ours. So why I think it's different from empathy or pity is when you're imagining, because you're imagining to be empathetic or to share suffering, you're immediately incorporating that experience into a view of yourself and your own worldview. Mm. What Arendt wanted was actually something a bit more radical than that, is to imagine something that's not your world, that makes you feel uncomfortable. Mm. And that's where the work has to start. And that's why she was also very committed to thinking.
Right.
Just, to the activity of thinking.
Yes.
And which is how you do that.
Right. And I mean, I absolutely wanted to talk to you about that. And, this is a moment of a lot of emotion out on the surface of public life. And honestly, Americans have a very conflicted kind of relationship historically and philosophically with thought and ideas. It's a different thing than it was, for example, in the Germany that Hannah Arendt was raised in, the power of ideas. But it feels to me like there might be a receptivity now, precisely because we see that it's not getting us anywhere to be meeting my emotion with your emotion. As you say, you can only have moral imagination if you also think, if you are thinking. You talked in this podcast I heard you in that brought me to you in our time about how she always talked about the dialogue we have in our heads, that we are constantly working out what it means to be human, to be a person, whether we realize it or not.
I mean, she took this from Socrates, and then from Heidegger. But her sense of what it meant to be a thinking person was always to be having the two-in-one dialogue in your head. As Valéry says, now I think, now I am. Je pense, je suis. And I think one of the reasons that she seized on Greek philosophy as a young woman and seized rather too literally on Heidegger as a young woman was the endorsement of the idea that thinking wasn't about mastery. It wasn't about thinking about stuff in order to control it or to rationalize it. Mm-hmm. Thinking was a way of being. The passion of being was in thinking. And that comes from that two-in-one dialogue in one's head. And for her, that was the beginning of moral life, comes in that dialogue. I mean, she's channeling Socrates here big time. It's like, Socrates says, you wouldn't want to commit murder because you don't want to live with a murderer. And she uses the example, which I love very much, of Richard III, who is indeed a murderer, but he is one that has a dialogue with himself. And that great soliloquy where Richard III ruminates to himself, am I a villain? Me? Call myself a villain? Etc., etc. And Arendt says, at least compared to Eichmann, he was having the conversation. At least there's a notion of evil that is there. That also follows, there is a notion of judgment that comes through thinking and dialogue.
Reflection.
Thinking, she says, is it's not the same as judgment, but it creates the right conditions for judgment. Being able to tell what is right and what is wrong. So thinking in terms of that inner dialogue, but also she says if you can't have that inner dialogue, then you can't speak and act with others either, because it's part of, if you're already divided in yourself because you're having this conversation with yourself and that's the passion of your being, people who can do that can actually then move on to having conversations with other people and then judging with other people. And what she called the banality of evil was the inability to hear another voice, the inability to have a dialogue either with oneself or the imagination to have a dialogue with the world, the moral world.
Right. And so one of her famous phrases is the banality of evil, which was an observation she made about Eichmann at the Nuremberg trial. And that was controversial, but it is absolutely, it's with us. And And yes, that was one of the key things that she observed about him, that he couldn't think, that somehow he had ceased thinking or turned that part of himself off to the point that it didn't seem possible for him anymore. And that so it was connected to evil and to that banality of the evil.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think I just say, and I think a lot of historians have pointed out that she underestimated Eichmann. Mm-hmm. And he was sort of, in some way, feigning. Not only was he banal, he was feigning banality.
Yeah.
And okay. I think mm-hmm. I think that's the point. I think mm-hmm. she did. Mm-hmm. But I think she was also trying very hard to understand this new evil that had gone in the world, which was banal. And I think she saw her. She sat there. She wrote to Carl Jaspers. She said, "I have to go and look at this living nightmare in the face. Mm-hmm. I have to go and see it."
And which is not to say trivial, right? I mean, that sometimes people get hung up on the word. It's not to say trivial, but it's to say not this satanic drama, but a human being.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know. Yeah, she might have not wanted to give Eichmann the title of human being. Make no mistake. She was no friend. But I think what she couldn't get over was the level of banality. So there is this man who he doesn't seem to know where he is. He's sitting there in Jerusalem at the trial of the century, mm-hmm. confronting survivors who are telling him telling the world what has happened. This extraordinary
outpouring
of
genocide
grief.
of the genocide.
Exactly. Yep. And he sits there and he says, "Oh, do you know, I was a Zionist." And you know, you can literally people's jaws dropping. Mm-hmm. It's just where does he think he is? I mean, this is if you look at the transcripts of the trial, right towards the end. He turns around to the judges and says, "Well, you know, I'm guilty in an illegal sense, but you know, and one day maybe I'm kind of guilty. Maybe I'd like to write a book about this to understand what I have discovered." And the judges' faces are, you know, they're trying so hard not to, you know, eye roll or jaw drop. You know, do you know where you are? Do you know what you're saying? Have you not realized how massively inappropriate and insulting it is even to say that? And I think it was that Arendt was trying to pick up on, and it was mm-hmm. trying to understand how the radical thoughtlessness of this man. And she was also, I mean, she said, you know, evil is like fungus. It spreads. It's something you find in the back of the woodshed. And I think she really had, you know, and the bureaucratization of human life allows that to happen.
Right.
So I think that's what she was doing. But on the other hand, it is, you know, the Eichmann trial is so difficult to talk about. Even those of us who love Hannah Arendt find it tricky. I have there was a photograph that used to hang in my... I was very lucky as a young academic to have W.S. Sebald as a colleague and friend, writer. And he had in his office this beautiful, which I now have, beautiful photo of Hannah Arendt at the Eichmann trial. And she's with Kurt Blumenfeld, who was the leader of the German Zionist organization and a very good friend of Hannah Arendt, who was with her at the Eichmann trial because he was translating for her. And he's got his arm half round her, and in his other hand, he's burying his face in his hand. It's a picture of grief and care. And there's Hannah Arendt, and she's staring straight across with her earphone in, listening to the translation, with this steely look of determination on her face, determined to understand what she's seeing. And the kind of combination of Blumenfeld with his care and sorrow, he looks like he's trying to care for her, and Arendt, she's just staring straight ahead with this look of sad determination. And that captures all the contradictions of that moment for me, her kind of failure to realize why what she was saying was so hurtful. She wouldn't do the emotion stuff. She just wouldn't do it. But also her absolute determination to say, you know, I'm going to look this living nightmare in the face, and I'm going to try as best I can to understand what's happening here. And what is happening here is a thoughtlessness that you will not put back in its glass box with the end of Eichmann. And I think you're quite right. I mean, it has proved to be the case.
You said something about the bureaucratization, which was part of that banality, part of a refuge for... Like it was, instead of thinking, you are part of the system and you follow the rules and you enact the rules. You know, and again, not to, I really would not compare Eichmann to anyone alive right now, in full, but the sense, the revulsion and the sense of alienation people all over the place have from bureaucracy, which in our age is globalized, right? The way the phrase the government will be received in many places in the U.S., the way the phrase the EU is received in England. There are echoes of you know, something that goes wrong. There's something that goes wrong in human societies that we're still with us or we're feeling again. I don't know.
Yeah. I think it's one of the first things Arendt did when she finally got to New York. One of her first jobs was to help edit Kafka's diaries. And she wrote a couple of essays on Kafka. And in those, you can see her, what she's responding to, especially in something like The Castle, where Kafka says famously, never before had life and bureaucracy been so close, been practically the same thing, that human life itself has become bureaucratized. You remember the story of The Castle, you know, the stranger, it's kind of a, it's a, certainly a migrant story. You know, the stranger arrives in a new place, he comes for work, and then he can't work out what's going on, and he can't settle, and, you know, he's blocked by this bureaucracy that no one understands. It sounds like any kind of, anyone who's worked with refugees or migrants in the last 10 years will know all too well Carr's experience as he tries to, you know, make good on the offer of work from The Castle. And I think it's very interesting that she actually chose that. I mean, she chose it, you know, because it resonated with her experience. But it goes back to the earlier conversation. I suppose, you know, the more we become fearful of what we call life, the more we try and bureaucratize to keep other people out, the worse it gets. So it is like this monster that is eating its own children in that respect, and also with the kind of with a logic that is no logic. I mean, that's the other thing, that it's the capricious nature of bureaucracy.
Yeah,
I mean, if I think
even
about the
well-meaning
EU,
bureaucracy, I mean, takes on these dehumanizing characteristics.
Well, this is very exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. this is where you know, humanitarianism is a very good example of how do we administer for human life?
Yeah,
and once you start to administer human life, you have very difficult decisions to make, and before you know it, you're in a situation where you're running very close to not committing atrocities, but you know, getting very, very close to causing harm rather than doing good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, if you talk to people who work for big aid agencies, you talk to people who've worked and then left big aid. This is, you know, if the bureaucratization of human life brings with it this penalty.
Yeah.
Even when you think you're doing good, which is why our Home Secretary, Amber Rudd, who was trying to explain why Britain would not be taking any more child refugees across from France, said, you know, it was a bad policy because it encouraged child refugees. And I felt like one of those judges or someone sitting there in Jerusalem in 1961 thinking, I'm sorry? Sorry, you're not helping child refugees because it might encourage more child refugees to come. Really? Is this a moral position?
Right.
No, it's an administrative position. And it's one that, you know, I don't think these people are evil, but I think they run very, very close to the wind with that kind of, that kind of, at best it's unthinking, at worst it's cynical.
Right. And let's talk about refugees. It's an important topic for you. I sometimes wonder. I remember the day after the presidential election, we had an event here, and you know, we with our news cycle, we kind of lurch from, you know, one drama to the next of what happened today that's really important, right? What happened today that mattered.
Yep.
And I often like to kind of step back and think, somebody looking back 100 years from now, like looking at this day, what will they see was happening in the world that in fact was important? And I feel like this refugee crisis that is so huge and ongoing and unresolved and no vision for resolving or even a sense of what that would mean might be that thing. And I know that's more present in Europe. It's not, it actually doesn't, I mean, Americans, it is as important, but it Americans don't have to feel it in quite the same way. And for you, that is, I wonder if you think if Hannah Arendt could come back with her cigarette in hand today, how she might ask us to be looking at this thing that is also happening kind of between and above and below and behind all the politics that we're paying attention to.
Yeah. I think she might say very politely, I did tell you. And I think for me, the so-called refugee crisis is actually part of a continuous history that Arendt gives us the tools to understand, partly because of her thinking and partly because she lived it. So it's a really clear example of her
She was an enemy alien, as we said.
She was an enemy alien. She was a refugee.
Person.
She was stateless for 18 years of her life. And I think if you look, one of my favorite essays from Arendt is an essay she published in 1943 for the Menorah Journal called We Refugees. And it's very, very biting. And it begins, the first line is just, in the first place, we do not like to be called refugees. And so this is a question of what happens to people, A, people, but also people when they get caught in categories that are not of their making. And she understood very well. She said, you know, before the word exile used to be, exiles used to be treated as sort of sacred figures or
right.
treated as hospitality
yeah.
in a war.
I read that. That's so interesting to think about. Everywhere yeah. the word exile, which once had an undertone of almost sacred awe, now provokes the idea of something simultaneously suspicious and unfortunate.
That's right. Yeah. And that, I mean, she said that, I think she said that in 43 as well.
Yeah.
And I think what she then went on to say was, well, you know, the things that are different. One is, you know, the sheer scale of the problem of people being pushed out in the 1940s was new. It wasn't altogether new. It had been coming for a long, long time in Europe. So that was new. But the other thing,
what
I think
is the
she's
scale?
Very, very good.
Do you have those numbers? I mean, the scale of it was just unbelievable. The numbers of people who.
It depends which bits you're talking about.
Yeah, right. There's the First World War.
So we can. I've run a project with colleagues at the University of East Anglia, colleagues from the history department called Refugee History, and we have lots of timelines with bars and numbers, which we're constantly revising as the different bits of history emerge. But big, and today also on a very, very similar scale, on a scale which, you know, causes real, real political trouble.
Yeah, millions,
and I think
20, tens of millions of people.
Tens of millions, And what she's very, very good on is saying, actually, this isn't a problem for refugees. This isn't a refugee crisis. This is a crisis for the European nation state. It's a crisis for what we think we're doing. And I think that really needs to be, put firmly. You know, the refugee problem isn't just the problem for people who happen to be refugees. It's a problem for everybody because it's a problem about how we're deciding to run our countries and our politics. And I think the other thing that she was very, very clear on is why I think she's very, very good today is she understood that humanitarianism or human rights would not be the answer to the question that was posed by people who, for whatever reason, found themselves outside their nation state. And she, one of the first things she pointed out is that what was exposed by the refugee crisis of the last century was how so-called human rights were actually political and national rights. So you only had as many rights as were guarded by the country in which you happened to be born. Once that country decided to de-citizenize you, that you were no longer a citizen, once it decided that it had no more responsibilities towards you, you were rightless. There was nothing to catch you apart from the capricious sympathy of others. And the capricious sympathy of others millions of Jewish people and others in mid-century Europe turned out to be a very, very poor provider of anything like human rights. Stop me if this sounds familiar.
So she
says, you know, the world, she said very famously, the world found nothing sacred in the abstract nakedness of being human.
Yeah.
The world found nothing sacred in the abstract nakedness of being human.
Yeah.
So then the question is, well, okay, so how are we going to have a political community that is hospitable, that is going to work in terms of protecting rights? And one thing, you know, she said after the war, refugees themselves didn't tend to call for human rights. They tended to call for their own nation.
They called for what? Their own nation.
Their own nation.
Yes.
You know, because
yes.
People know. Yeah. You know, right. We could be protected.
Yeah.
So there is this sort of question about, you know, how then are we going to imagine? And the question she'd say, then it becomes politics. Then it's about, you know, imagining what kind of nation state, what kind of sovereign politics might work for the modern world. And I think, you know,
and that's going to be such a different set of questions again in the 21st century. It's just not the proposal anyone would make.
Exactly. But she did, and she would have predicted that she had this expression, and you'll remember because you've read it recently, The Origins of Totalitarianism, called the dark background of difference. What happens when you're no longer visible in the political world, where you no longer have entitlements or presence, you no longer have rights, is you disappear into the dark background of difference, where she said the more interconnected the world gets, the more global it gets, the bigger the dark background of difference is going to get.
Right.
And therefore, the more threatened, the more threatened people who are, you know, consider themselves to be in political nation states, the more threatened they're going to be. So you're in this kind of, you know, scenario that is like a zero-sum game.
And that is where we are, and it's interesting. I mean, it's terribly interesting in a terrible way. I think that with globalization, which is not necessarily a word she would have used or predicted, but with globalization, there was this assumption, which actually didn't rest on a very sophisticated examination of the human condition, but there was this assumption that we would just grow out of that, right? But what she understood, because she was looking at the human condition and taking that seriously, is it, as you say, that dark background, that this would become a crisis again.
And she was also, I mean, she did, if you read The Human Condition, which is, I mean, I recommend to cheer you up, actually, in these dark
times.
Because it is a model of, you know, she'll talk about, you know, the importance of new beginnings, the importance of natality, the importance of action, the importance of speaking. And she'll talk about, you know, the world, you know, she'll talk about, it's a book that's concerned with worldliness. And she'll talk about the storybook of mankind, like we're all connected and we're all part of the world. But she was also, I mean, she had read Rosa Luxemburg. She understood capitalism. She was not naive. The more that globalization is about the accumulation of capital, it's expansion for expansion's sake. So it will not produce more equality. It will produce more inequality. Hence the background of difference. So trying to work for a worldliness that's genuinely worldly as against a worldliness which is actually about accumulation, expansion for expansion's sake, which will increase the divides between people. She would have understood that. If she would have been so impolite to say, "I told you so," I don't think she would have done. have been thinking it.
There is that paradox that I actually think is redemptive. Can be generative, that you mentioned a little while ago. I think that it doesn't make sense in terms of the way we imagine globalization, that in fact the local has become much more important again, right? New realities will be incubated, that there's a lot of power. There's, in fact, a lot of power at the local. I mean, the internet has a power to amplify this as well. That might seem nonsensical if we say, well, what we've done is we've made everybody connected and we're global.
And I think that's true. I think she would have wanted a proper politics with that. Which is to say, you know.
Local politicians. I mean, I think, you know, mayors in the States are much more vigorous characters right now and innovative than national politicians can be.
I mean, that's what she always, when she first came to the States, in a story I always find as a European rather hilarious, that she went off to Massachusetts to stay with a family to learn English. I mean, she wrote The Origins was written in her third language.
Right.
And so she did an immersion kind of, you know, au pair, not quite, she wasn't an au pair, but she was living in. And she wrote back you know, to her husband, Lucian, said, "Oh, it's awful, I can't smoke, I have to keep on going outside, I can't bear it, I can't bear it." And which, you know, does being very European. But what she was also absolutely puzzled and slightly bewitched by, she said, "It's very strange because there's a lot of political freedom in America because of, you know, because of the state system, because of federalism. There's a kind of political freedom there that she's really, you know, coming from fascist Europe, this just looks fantastic. But there's also a lot of social conformity, and she couldn't really marry the two things together. Hmm. So I think she always did like that, you know, that kind of sense. She also liked the, you know, she saw a lot of virtue in the early kibbutzes. She saw a lot of virtue in early Soviet collectivism. You know, anything where people were coming together to appear to one another, to take action together, to work out where the political would be. I think always she always liked very much. But she would also have, you know, warned us not to be complacent with just that. You do have an obligation to the world. You can't just go back to the local. You can't. I mean, she wrote very well about what she called, well, she wasn't the only one to call it, inner immigration. The idea that you might just sort of seek refuge in the small, or in other people like yourself, or on your Twitter feed.
Yes, not, inner. And I just want to. I just want to underline inner emigration. Which is, you know, another way you would call it, maybe tuning out, right, or retreating into one's bubble, as you say.
Which
could be the downside of thinking, or I suppose a choice not to engage, not to think, not to engage politically.
I think. I mean, quite often. I mean, immigration was a term that many German intellectuals used. Many people who didn't, because they had the luxury not to to leave Europe. And say, well, I was always opposed in my head. I was always an immigrant. I was a dissident in my head. Arendt was, as you can imagine, contemptuous. Well, thanks. And she, you know, she says in a throwaway comment, there's so many inner immigrants in Nazi Germany. It's amazing, and so many people opposed to what they were doing in their heads. So, I mean, this for her was a corruption of where thinking should take you. It's not good enough just to sort of. And I think, you know, I mean, I can imagine her being very scathing about Twitter for exactly those reasons. It's not good enough just to sit there agreeing with one another, or to sort of come up with a world that, you know, you think should be exist. It's far more difficult to face a reality, you know, the reality of the world that does exist, that isn't to your liking. And so, you know, thinking, I think she found it as a real conflict because she loved solitude. I mean, she was a very good friend to people, but I think she, like a lot of intellectuals, she liked wandering around in the field thinking to herself. And she found it kind of, you know, painful to be dragged into public and political life, but she'd never let herself off the hook on that one. You know, you have to take, thinking has to be a prelude to judgment. You have to get back into political life. But I think the tendency for inner immigration now is, I mean, I think we all do it ourselves. You know, it's just the rest of the world is mad.
Well, and also, it's overwhelming. There's an overwhelming amount of information and you know, events going on. I mean, I want to talk about other things. Before we kind of leave the refugee crisis behind, obviously we're not going to come up with a game plan right here, and nor do we, you know, could we say what Hannah Arendt, perhaps, maybe you can, what she would direct us to do right now. I just want to underscore a point you make in your writing. Because that we need to be pondering this, and we need to be having a kind of conversation, including that inner conversation. I mean, you say, and you're channeling Arendt, when you have a refugee crisis, what you also have is a political, existential, and moral crisis about what a country is and who its citizens are. And you also point out that possibly the reason this makes us panic is because what it puts before our eyes is, as you say, that, you know, if human rights are contingent, that we in fact are all vulnerable. And of course, that is a terrifying thing. It's a terrifying specter. But then we retreat, we respond to that vulnerability by right, in a way that is punitive and to our fellow citizens, and I think eventually, as you know, to us as societies, as citizens, as countries.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you stop to, I mean, I do think there's a lot of truth in that vulnerability, because if you stop to think about it, with refugees, if we think about rights in general, we have lots of rights that are protected, the right to education, and certain gender rights, certain rights around race, certain rights about health. When you're a refugee, you become a refugee by just where you happen to be born and when you happen to be born. That's it. It's the accident of birth.
Right.
It's the accident of birth that, you know, makes you either American or European or British or English as well. So it is purely contingent. Yeah. It is, you know, and I think there's something about that that people really do find threatening. So that's why we get people sort of, you know, somehow imagining where they happen to be born entitles them to more than someone else who happens to have been born somewhere else. And when you stop me, in the human condition, Arendt borrows a phrase which she takes from Herodotus called isonomia, which is the principle of equal liberty. And she says you need to have a political community which is capable of responding to isonomia, or this principle of equal liberty. And basically the principle of equal liberty says, well, how come I've got total freedom of movement and you haven't? Mm-hmm. How come, you know, my child gets a really good education and yours doesn't? How come my mum can grow vegetables in her garden and your mother's garden's just been blown to bits? That's not good enough. And she says, you know, we need to have, there needs to be enough in the way we think about political democratic life for to allow citizens and people to act on the principle of equal liberty. And on the one hand, the situation we have now is a kind of phobic repudiation of vulnerability, everyone's vulnerability.
Right.
Which is very, very bad. But on
it's a rejection of vulnerability as though it is something we could reject. We say we will not be vulnerable.
Exactly. We will not be vulnerable.
Right.
We can prove this.
Right.
But on the other hand, remember the biggest refugee populations now are not actually in Europe. They're in Jordan, they're in Lebanon, they're in Turkey. Yeah. They're in communities which quite often are refugee communities themselves. I mean, some of the biggest people who've hosted refugees are existing, either Palestinian or Kurdish or the Christian communities in the Middle East, who are literally making space for a new generation of refugees. That's not always an easy relationship. I don't want to idealize the local, or I don't want to idealize the idea of refugee to refugee humanitarianism, because it comes with all those difficulties. But it does seem to me that the principle of equal liberty or isonomia is working effectively elsewhere in the world. So it should not be beyond the wit and wisdom of the rest of us to use a bit more moral imagination. Because it's not as if it's not happening. It is. And it also is happening, both in Europe and in the States with the people who are redwood are called the new people, with a new generation of activists.
Mm-hmm. It's actually happening in communities, in local communities that have taken in refugees in both of our countries, all over Europe, right? There. And those stories don't make the headlines. I mean, you get them as these feature pieces.
And it's often...
Canada, they're incredible, right? Yeah.
Yeah. But it's often, so that's not big politics. That's often, you know, in the Middle East, it would be the local mosque, just as it was Jewish groups who helped the last refugee crisis. Yeah. It's local Muslim groups in both Canada and the US and the UK. It's often Muslim groups, often Christian groups. I mean, it's places where you wouldn't, you know, that aren't the big humanitarian agencies, that aren't big government, but are acting. So I think it's important to recognize that those principles of political community are. We are creating spaces for them, but goodness, we need to push against the phobic repudiation of, as you said, vulnerability much, much harder.
Yeah, you said something so important just a minute ago, and I want to dwell with that a little bit. That, you know, this idea that there's a danger in invoking somebody like Hannah Arendt. That, you know, here we're bringing in this great intellectual, and that somehow that implies abstraction, or that this is not thinking, or even the way she thought about thinking is not for ordinary people. But what you just said about, you know, her validation of the, you know, the actual power and freedom of a human being to keep idea and possibility alive. You know, that something might change. I mean, that's moral imagination. And just as you said, I mean, honestly, these are simple, simple, straightforward questions that I think, and this is not just about refugees. You know, in the States now, I think so many of us, we're living, and you know, this idea of equal liberty, like we're living with this inequity, these disparities. And I know it's the same thing in the West, in all of our countries. And it, you know, to most people, I think wherever they are on the spectrum, you know, it's uneasy. It feels wrong, right? But her insisting that our power to say, I don't want to live this way. I don't want my children to have opportunities that are simply unthinkable for children in that neighborhood over there. And the power of putting those questions and those longings, and that kind of insistence out in the world.
Yeah, and I think also, I think that's right, but I also would not want to, I mean, Hannah Arendt sometimes got it wrong. So what in my dream world, we have a generation of people who read Arendt with and against her.
Okay.
That's what she said of Heidegger. I mean, against Heidegger, who, we've all made mistakes in our love life, but that was a big one.
Yeah, well,
she said,
Nazi
I always thought with and against him.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. I've always thought with and against him. And I do my thinking on the ground, which I think is what you're saying there. Thinking's not abstraction. It's not just something that happens in the universities or for the liberal elite or between the covers of the New Yorker. We're all thinking. We're all doing it all the time.
Yeah.
And I think, but in a concrete way. But also, I mean, she had her blind spot. She got the experience of Black Americans very wrong, repeatedly. And I think that did come from a certain inability.
How did she get that wrong?
She wrote a very famous piece, which, again, took about ill-advised bits of her life. Mm-hmm. One, Heidegger. Two, she commented on Little Rock in 1957.
Okay.
You know, these are quite big mistakes.
Right.
And she was responding to the very famous photograph of, I think it's Elizabeth Eckford, going into school, being harangued by her classmates, by her white classmates. And it's a very distressing photo. And Arendt does something which is sort of unforgivable, which she says, education shouldn't be where we're fighting these debates, fighting the battle, civil rights battle. We shouldn't be putting our kids up against this. We shouldn't. Education is a social experience that should be kept apart from politics. Mm. And she did it in a kind of tone which Ralph Ellison referred to, I think, as Irving Howe and to her, you know, that Olympian tone where you look over at other people's experience and you do not stop to check yourself.
Right.
You do not stop to think, well, maybe I'll shut up on this one. And Ellison wrote back to her and said, a lot of people challenged her because it was a total misunderstanding. What she was doing, I think, was responding to her own very European experience of being a Jewish child and bullied and her sense of wanting a space of education to be free of politics. And Ralph Ellison turned around to her and said, look, you know, for black children in the South, their life is already political. They're already being sacrificed day in, day out. Basically, you're talking about a fantasy.
Right.
And she did actually,
right.
did acknowledge that. But it seemed to me that was just one example of, you could have someone who's thinking on the ground, who's thinking about moral imagination, who can be totally blind.
Right.
And I think if I was to honour Hannah Arendt, it would, or if we were to sort of do things in her name in terms of thinking and judging, she would expect us to be hard about that and to call her on a political experience that, I mean, she understood. I mean, she understood perfectly well what political racism felt like, but
right.
she would not or could not make that leap. But I did want to say that because otherwise you do end up, she sounds like a model. She wasn't, you know, there were some serious errors there.
One thing that I've heard you say about her thinking is that felt very resonant for me is, and also in terms of this equal liberty idea, that the power we have to say that's not fair, that you said, I'm not sure where you were, if this is from Origins of Totalitarianism, I don't think so, that what we need are vibrant communities that can change without risk, a community that is okay with promising, and a culture of forgiveness. Can you talk about that? Those ideas?
Yeah, she says that in in the human condition.
Okay.
Which is the, I mean, modern life, the human condition is unpredictable. This is what, since the advent of modernity, we've had rapid change. The world has become unpredictable in new ways. So I think she says, for the first time ever, and she's writing this in the late 50s, the pace of technological change is outstripped man's ability to adapt to change. So there's a whole set of things that...
Wait, that's more true now than it was then.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah. If we thought Star Trek looked scary, that's far truer. So a lot of, the post-Reformation, we've got the turn to the self, we've got new technology which is outpacing our ability to be, we've got a kind of sense of the world slipped off its axis. So how does the human condition function in a world like that? How would anything like a political community help? And she says, well, the two things you need is, on the one hand, the ability to make and honour promises. And this is, anyone who's a parent knows how this works. You have to say, this will happen, and it will happen. I will make sure it happens.
Right. And every once in a while it won't. But you're saying that there needs to be a foundation of that. That we trust each other.
It needs to be the faith. Someone who is going to promise you that this will happen.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to keep good on that, you also, and it took me ages to understand this, you need a culture of forgiveness. And it took me quite a long time to understand this because I'm not a very naturally forgiving person, if I'm totally honest with myself. So, and also my image of Arendt was always like, she's kind of really tough. And, she talks truth to lots of things. And it wasn't stuff about forgiveness. It sounds a bit meh. And what she means is, if you're going to have a culture that takes risks, if you're going to embody risks, and if we're going to get to anything like equal liberty or a better political culture, or at least a culture of ideas, you're going to have to take risks. And if you're going to do that, you're going to get things wrong. You're going to make errors.
Mm-hmm.
And so a mature political community needs the capacity for forgiveness, to accept that, things go wrong.
Yeah.
People make mistakes.
Yeah.
And I think that, again, if you turn back to your earlier point about the culture in Great Britain and the US at the moment, one of the responses to that loneliness is to people to want an alternative, which is a fantasy,
mm-hmm.
where everything will be looked after. We're going to do this and it'll be fine.
Right.
And so the capacity to have a kind of political community based on, it's going to be imperfect.
Right.
The way both our recent elections were fought, on absolutes.
Yeah. There are promises being made that can't be kept.
Promises that can't be kept, and watch and wait.
Yeah.
But also a kind of infantilization of electorates.
Yeah.
Goes that we will make the world safe. And you think, you're kidding? I'm 52 years old. I know you're not going to make the world safe.
Yeah.
Feed me another line.
But also the culture of forgiveness to me feels very important to put out there. It feels also very countercultural right now. I mean, there's also this hardening of lines, you were for that, or you voted for that candidate, or against that, or against that candidate. And then there's this whole world of assumptions made about you. And even at the same time that we're very frustrated with people on the other side, whatever the other side is, we will not let them, change, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
The minute anything shifts or there's some kind of conciliatory move made, authentic or not, it's immediately swatted down. I mean, this idea of what did you say, a mature culture of forgiveness that means the kind of a pact in the middle of our life together that says we want to change, we will extend some modicum of openness.
Yeah. I think it's also a question of where that happens, though, because I think in big politics, the cynicism, and it's a cynicism, it's utterly deserved.
Yeah.
Is I'm not going to play that game because I know you're just playing a game.
Yeah.
I know this is a game.
Yeah.
And when Arendt talks about, when she there's one of I think it's one of the most moving passages of Origins of Totalitarianism. She evokes Augustine, who she wrote her dissertation on. And she wrote her dissertation on Augustine's notion of love. And, you know, he would talk about, you know, worldly love, appetite, desire, which is love of the future, transcendent love, which is the love of God, which is the past. And the love that she was really interested in was neighbourly love, which is neither, you know, neither wanting transcendence nor wanting something or someone. It's just the love that says, I want you to be. And she returns to that saying of Augustine, that idea of neighbourly love in The Origins of Totalitarianism. But she says that's the kind of love that's available in the dark background of difference. It's not the love that you're going to find on the political stage.
Right.
It is because that's all you've got in the dark background of difference is neighbourly love in her phrasing. And it's very interesting to me that she doesn't try and find it in, you know, the political, which was, you know, sine qua non for her. The political theatre was everything to her. But she said, no, actually, you know, love, that kind of neighbourly love is in the dark background of difference. And it is, you know, she'll also say, you know, love is something, as soon as you bring it into the light of day, it kind of crumbles in the sunlight. You know, it disappears. So I think if you were going to say something, if I said to her now, let's have a culture of political forgiveness, and she'd look at me, she'd say, oh, grow up. No. Right. You know, look at these guys. Are you kidding me?
Right. Well, and I wouldn't say, so politics is the most, is where it's become a caricature, where we have a caricature of the opposite of that, in fact. So I would never say a political culture, for goodness, because that would not be reasonable or realistic, but a culture of forgiveness. We don't need our politicians, do we?
to shifting
our culture.
And I think that would come back to what she says about creating a space where you can think, because once you start having these conversations with yourself and with others, you do, and once you start imagining yourself in another place, then forgiveness does follow. And sometimes it doesn't. but I think she was very passionate about education. I think she kind of idealized education in a sense that she'd have liked the kind of great German idea of the Bildung to be available to everybody.
Yeah, which is also like it's formation, right? It's not just education.
Exactly.
That word is formation.
Exactly, it's formation.
Yeah.
And I think she was romantic about that. But she was also, you know, we need spaces where we can think and try these ideas out. Yeah. And you're not going to have anything like even a local community or a political culture of anything like that can keep its promises or forgive.
Right.
Unless people are allowed to think. And that's the thing about, going back to your earlier point about loneliness.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, in order to think, you actually, in a way, you need to be in a culture which allows you, which endorses that process of thinking.
Yeah. Yes, and creates space for
it. And you need to make it a culture that kind of makes sense. When she says in the final late chapter of Origins of Totalitarianism, that, you know, she's responding to George Orwell here, and she says, you know, 2 + 2 will never make 5. That's not the problem. And, you know, George Orwell, you know, at the end, Winston's being tortured and he's made to say 2 + 2 = 5. And this is like, you know, totalitarianism makes us all lie. She said, that's not the power. It's the fact that in a world where people are going to say it is, even though they know it isn't, that is deeply estranging. That's what creates those conditions of loneliness and despair.
Mm-hmm.
It's because you've lost, you know, that idea that, you know, Kant was very fond of a essential community where people could at least sort of say, this sounds reasonable. this is our version of judgment. You know, I think it myself and you guys think it. Okay, let's start from here. And that goes. That for her is the wickedness of the political lie. People don't believe that 2 + 2 = 5. They don't believe half of what's said.
That we can get ourselves and others to the point where we might say something like that. Some equivalent of that. We're going to have to wind down here, but I've got so much else I want to talk. But I want to talk briefly, and this follows on that, I think of the idea of lying, right?
Yeah.
Which was a one of those elements of totalitarianism, very much a subject alive in American politics now. This, you know, where did she say? The ideal subject of totalitarian rule is not the convinced Nazi or the convinced communist, but people for whom the distinction between fact and fiction and the distinction between true and false no longer exist.
But I
find, and so I think that, I could say that in any American political space right now, and everybody on every side would say, oh, yes. And they would be thinking of the other side.
I tweeted that, and if you tweet that quote, it runs.
Right, it would run. But something I'm very intrigued, getting a little bit deeper into this and reading her, is that, and I mean, I've thought a lot about, we already had a crisis. I think we did, like a lot of things right now, it's just out on the surface, what was already kind of fermenting. We already had a crisis of truth, or not being able to speak about truth in a complex way. And we've been relying on facts, and facts were never enough. And she makes these, like, here's her essay, Lying in Politics. She says, the deliberate falsehood deals with contingent facts. That is, with matters that carry no inherent truth within themselves, no necessity to be as they are. Factual truths, here's it. Factual truths are never compellingly true. The historian knows how vulnerable is the whole texture of facts in which we spend our daily life. It is always in danger of being perforated by single lies or torn to shreds. Yeah. Facts need testimony to be remembered and trustworthy domain of human affairs. From this, it follows that no factual statement can ever be beyond doubt. Take us inside that and what that means for us now.
I think, I think she's for Arendt, I think why the idea of thinking and speaking as a form of action are important to her is that what she's saying there is, I mean, you can throw enough facts, you can throw all the facts you like at people and they will not stick. We had this in the UK, and I know you have too. That it's okay against the false news. We'll have fact finding, and we'll tell you, and we'll have a team of researchers, and you just have to look on our website, and we'll tell you which of those are lies. And you can scream facts at people till you're blue in the face. And a lot of colleagues in universities and journalists have been doing exactly that, very hard, working tirelessly, and it's not making any difference. And I think what she's talking about there is the ability through thinking and communal discourse to make truth meaningful in the world. It has to happen between people.
Right.
Which is not saying we just make up our own reality. She's not saying that. It means that this is why...
When she says testimony, it needs testimony. It needs
testimony.
Experience. It needs human experience around it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. It needs storytelling. I mean, we're used to thinking about Arendt as a political scientist, but I mean, she wrote so much about literature. She understood the way that language worked.
Yeah.
For her, and she writes incredibly well. I mean, when you teach Arendt students, they just say, compared to a lot of things we have to read, this is beautiful. This is very beautiful. And so I think she that was why testimony was important to her. It's why history and the sense of myth were all important to her, because it's what makes truth meaningful to people together in a community. Mm-hmm. And what endures was absolutely key to her, which is why storytelling was very important to her. I mean, she has this figure she'll remember from that. I think it's from the same essay called The Truth Teller, which is she's borrowing there from her very good friend Walter Benjamin, another refugee who didn't make it. His idea of the storyteller, and what the storyteller is doing is creating a political reality through his or her truth telling, and I think that's what she was talking about. So if you want a culture that's going to take on fake news and the political lie, I say as someone who teaches literature and history, what you need is a culture of the arts and humanities. What you need is more storytelling. What you need is more discourse. What you need is more imagination. What you need is more creation in that way, and more of a sense of what it is that ties us to those words and ties us to those stories.
Right, and ties us to each other. Right, that loneliness it mitigates that loneliness.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bit in the Eichmann and Jerusalem, and Arendt often criticised, to my mind, quite rightly, for not showing due respect to people who were giving testimony in the Eichmann trial, who were telling their stories for the first time, first time in Israel, first time in their families. It was an extraordinary moment. But the one story she stops with is the story of Zindel Grinspan, who was Herschel Grinspan's father. Herschel Grinspan was the man who assassinated a German diplomat, which was a pretext for Kristallnacht. And Zindel Grinspan gives his testimony of being pushed over the border, pushed over the Polish border. And Arendt's listening to this, and she stops and she says, "I just thought everyone should have their moment in court. There was something that was so unique about the way he told that story, the way that this old man's story about being pushed across the border, being physically de-citizened, right, resonated and managed to tell the whole story of what was happening in that courtroom." And that's the truth. I mean, that's in her right, mind would be a historical, a factual, and a poetic and a human truth that the culture needs to pay attention to, needs to find space for. Does that sort of answer your question?
Yeah.
So we need more stories. We need more stories. We need better stories.
Yeah. Right.
And
we need three-dimensional, right? We need stories and facts and conversations between people and all of that working together, right? I keep thinking, and I don't even know if this is appropriate here, but I keep thinking of a story that's just in actually the show we're going to have on the air this week, which is a civil conversation. We had this project with two people in really different places on the American spectrum, and I spoke with one of the people I spoke with in this conversation is she's a young millennial African American progressive activist. You know, all these ways we can describe who people are. Amazing woman. And she has had this kind of transformative encounter that has gotten some press because it went viral. And with somebody, a white man from North Carolina, who called her up on a show and said, "I'm racist," right? But talked about the fear that he walked around with, right? The effect that this had on him. And he didn't want to be racist. So, I mean, I kind of think Arendt would like this because he was seeing himself as an ism, right?
Yeah.
In that ism, which is never telling the whole story. And he kind of removed himself from that. And again, what I like about this story, too, is that this is not, as you say, we're not talking ivory tower. You don't have to be an intellectual like Hannah Arendt. I mean, basically what he did is he engaged his mind. He started thinking about this and actually in the moment questioning the reactions he was having to people of color and changed himself. And so that's a story, but it's so much bigger.
Is.
It's so much bigger than facts. It's so much bigger than labels, and it creates a different kind of truth, sense of truth and what can be possible.
But it also, I mean, this is why I'd be very interested to see what the young woman has to say. Mm-hmm. I mean, it reminds me very much of when Arendt went back to Germany to collect the Lessing Prize, which she was given, and she gave a speech. And, you know, Lessing was this great humanist and great believer in dialogue. And one thing she said to her audience, you know, I'm talking to you as a Jewish person. Mm-hmm. You need to take that on board. And what she said, you know, what would not have been helpful during the Third Reich is to say, you know, Jews and Germans are part of the same humanity. We all love each other. She said, because that would have been to totally disregard the reality that you're living in a political system that says that one of you is not.
Right.
Far better, she says, to say a German and a Jew and France. So you acknowledge the reality of the politics, of the racial politics that is making an idea of a shared humanism impossible. But you're maintaining its possibility by acknowledging that reality and doing like your guys, doing your stuff in spite of that. I think that there's something, you know, in your story and in Arendt's story there, which does resonate, is she would have been very suspicious of a false type of humanitarianism that tried to pretend that the politics of race weren't violent and horrible. Yeah. And real. And real for ways that are unimaginable for a lot of people. But you acknowledge that, and then you say, and still we're going to sit in the studio together, and still we're going to read this text together, and still we're going to do this together. And I think it's something, I mean, the kind of Tuffy in me wants to say you stick with that reality.
It's allowing the complexity of reality in.
Yes.
And yes. It's always messy.
Yeah.
The origins of totalitarian ends with these words. It says, but there remains also the truth that every end in history necessarily contains a new beginning. This beginning is the promise, the only message, in quotes, which the end can never produce. Beginning, before it becomes a historical event, is the supreme capacity of man. Politically, it is identical with man's freedom. And then she quotes Augustine, that a beginning be made, man was created. And she writes, this beginning is guaranteed by each new birth. It is indeed every man. I mean, those are very lofty words and really kind of surprising at the end of this book, which is about the darkest depths of humanity. But I want to just, you reflecting on all of this, are talking about, you know, you've just used the word friendship, like, you know, very concrete on the ground ways to realize what she said. You know, you when you had this scenario that I read earlier, you know, she might conclude saying to us, you'd be best advised and make some new friends so that together you can learn to think without banisters.
Yeah.
Is that a phrase of hers, think without banisters?
Think without banisters is her phrase. Uh-huh. Yeah. How do you, I mean, she's in response to the Holocaust in particular. I mean, how once the impossible has been made possible, how do we judge? How do we think? And that was her motivating question. But her concern with beginnings or what she called natality.
Yeah.
I mean, Heidegger was always being towards death. She was always being towards the possibility of life. And I think it came through in two ways in her life. One is through friendship, because each new encounter, especially when you're actually out of your bubble. I mean, she's talking about Lessing's Nathan the Wise. And that's the kind of, you know, that's a story about Judaism, Christianity and Islam and people deciding that one isn't the better. And none of those are the superior religion. But actually, they can actually have a dialogue. I mean, it's a real text for our time.
Which would also have been really revolutionary then. I mean,
it would, it was. And so friendship, but not friendship. You know, friendship that has to work. Which is, you know, when I talk, you know, about, you know, people working refugee to refugee humanitarianism, that's a difficult kind of friendship, but it's a friendship that has to work. But also, when I was looking in her teaching file, which really brought home to me, is the importance of, for her, of her students, the importance of the people she called the new people. Mm. And I think, you know, I don't think we're ever going to have the education, you know, the political free education that Arendt dreamed of, that formation. But I think that kind of affirmation of teaching, of listening to students, of empowering students, of, you know, making it possible for students to create the kind of the new ideas of citizenship. Those are things she believed in very strongly. And the older I get and the darker the times get for me, and I know a lot of other people who work in universities and schools feel this, the place where I see new birth are in my students. And I think they are, you know, that is the beginning. You know, out of the darkest times there will be, you know, there can be a new beginning. And we need to step back and shut up sometimes and do the most we can to make sure that happens.
And anything else? Anything else? I know there's so much we could still talk about.
So much we could talk about.
I think you'd really want to say that.
I feel like I've been talking in this dark, dark room.
Oh, you have?
Yes.
Sorry.
No. It's nice. It's very Arendtian, because what's nice about not being able to see you is I think Arendt would have liked radio. I mean, a lot of people from the mid 20th century liked radio because although it did bad things in terms of propaganda, it made you listen to the voice.
Yeah.
And listen to what someone is saying, very carefully. So I think in terms of sort of the kind of encounters that Arendt would have liked, she would have wholly approved of conversation by radio. It would have been a Socratic.
Well, right. Well, because, and I mean, I do live interviews and I do public events. What I have learned to do is, so, you know, what I've become very aware of in my discipline is how much other information you're taking in, visual information, when you're sitting with someone.
Yes. Yes.
And it is such a great gift and a discipline to be able to listen completely, right? To only be encountering the voice. But I say to people, yeah, it's not like talking on the phone. It's really like it's like the Vulcan mind meld. Like your thoughts are coming into my mind and my thoughts are coming into you. You know, we are just, it is, it's a beautiful meeting of thinking, yeah, but it is embodied.
Also very much what Arendt said about thinking, because in a radio culture, people are listening as they're washing their floors or going for their runs or they're in everyday life. So there is that kind of, you know, the two-in-one the Socratic two-in-one that Arendt so liked, I think is, you know, radio is a medium that allows that to happen.
Well, I'm just thrilled. I just found this thrilling, and I'm so glad you were able to do it, and I'm excited to put it on the air.
Great. I'm now exhausted.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then you go away and relax. We put the unedited interview out as well as the produced show. The produced show goes out on the radio and it goes out as a podcast, but we also, hundreds of thousands of people will possibly 500,000 will also listen to this unedited, and I'm really glad about that because this was really rich.
Great. I really enjoyed it. My people know, when do you...
I think we have it... before it goes out, we'll send you the link. We'll let you know. May 18th is what we have on the schedule now.
Okay,
that could change, but you will absolutely. We'll give you plenty of, you know. You'll know when it's happening. It won't just come out. Thank you so much. I'm just thrilled to keep following you.
Such great questions.
Okay,
and I could have gone and got a large glass of Toulouse wine and then come back.
All right. Well, maybe one day we'll meet and we could. I would actually really enjoy that.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, next time you're in Europe I come to the States a lot. So.
Okay. Well, if you ever come to Minnesota, come see us. But I'm actually going to be in the UK in July. Are you going to be there in July? Do you know?
For the first 3 weeks, and then I'll come back to France.
Okay.
So maybe if you drop me the dates, that would be nice.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Have a good. Go rest now.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Okay, then.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.